The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
As the school year winds down, the Department of Education and Youth is preparing for the coming school year, announcing today the Education Plan 2025, which includes provision for up to 90 therapists in 45 special schools across the country. But where will those resources come from? Well, joining us now to answer that and lots more is the Minister for Education and Youth, Helen McEntee. Minister, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. Hi.
Will these therapists be in place by September?
Well, firstly, can I just say you mentioned the education plan. What I'm publishing today is a broader plan for this year, really setting out what are my ambitions, what are the actions that I'm going to do with my department, with all of our education stakeholders to make sure that every child is supported in school. Part of that and a central part of that is rolling out therapies in our schools. What I've done over the last number of months through my department, working closely with the National Council for Special Education, working with our partners in health and in children, is set out a plan as to how we do that. So the intention is not for this September, because we have to start hiring staff and that will only start in the next week, is that we will in this school year, so for the 25 to 26 school year, start hiring for up to 45 special schools.
And 90 therapists is the target.
It's occupational therapists, it's speech and language therapists, and these will be therapists for the first time that are hired by education, the National Council for Special Education. They won't come from the HSE, they won't be part of the Child and Disability Network teams. They will be specifically education therapists. They will be in our special schools to start with. They will move to our mainstream and our special education classrooms, but we have to start somewhere and we want to make sure that we're starting in our special schools.
So these 90 into 45 special schools means on average two per school. And that's a start. But you'll need many more if you're going to move therapy into mainstream schools for those who require it.
You will, absolutely. I mean, at the moment, we have 124 special schools across the country. We have five new opening this September. So obviously, starting with 45, the remaining then will be put in place the year after that. We need to make sure we have the therapists in place, as I've said, as of next week. So we have to go through the funding process. As of next week, we'll be in a position to start hiring those therapists. And I expect that you'll have people who are new to the positions. I'll expect that there are people maybe in other roles and people who are already working in education who might apply for them. But we are working separately in government to make sure that we can increase the number of people who are coming out of our colleges who are training as speech and language.
I mean, can you convert from being an ordinary teacher to being one of these special therapists? Or do you come from the therapy background rather than the educational background?
So the vast majority will have come through therapies. It's what they'll have studied and gone through in college. But what we're looking at is ways in which we can allow, be it somebody who's a teacher, an SNA or in another profession, to be able to move over or to change profession, to change therapies if that's what they wish. There's work already has been done. So working with James Lawless, who's our Minister for Further and Higher Education, a memo was brought recently to Cabinet after a body of work has been done with our current universities, the current situation they have, which will increase the number of places for lots of different therapies, but this will include speech and language and occupational therapies. What's most important, if I could say, and bring it back to this, what's most important about this is that there will be children in schools that will be directly getting therapies. So we have a number of pilots and work in place at the moment. But this will mean children are getting the therapies. It means it'll be in the schools. It's where they are. They're not going to be taken out of school. It'll be surrounded by their peers. The teachers will be learning from it and their parents will be learning from it as well.
What feedback have you had from parents about the current situation where they depend on the resources, say, of the HSE for therapy?
Being very honest, it's some really good feedback and some really not so good feedback. And it's very patchy and it depends on where you are. And I'll be very clear, there's really fantastic people working in the HSE and in our health service. But the structure as it currently exists is not working for children. It's not getting directly to them. And that is why we are bringing it back to this. We need to make sure where children spend so much of their time, and that is in school, that we're not taking them out to go to some other environment that's alien to them, that the therapists are there, they're with them, they're supporting them, they're providing them the direct therapies, but that also the teachers who spend so much time with them are learning from that as well.
Now, you talk there, you don't want to take kids out of school and have them going off to special treatment, as it were, taking them out of mainstream school. Now, yesterday on the programme, we had a principal of a school Nave Owen in Crumlin in Dublin, which caters for MGLD. This is children with mild general learning disabilities. And they were in receipt of a circular from your department. And if you put on your headphones, you can hear something of what Debbie had to say, because she is quite dismayed as to the implications for her school of what your department intends.
inclusion is the aim of every educator. Of course, it would be ideal to have all students go to their local school, but that's just not possible at the moment. So what we can't do is create another crisis by trying to solve the one that's there at the moment. And that seems to be what the government are pushing. They're putting up a lot of places for those with the complex needs by taking away from those with other disabilities. We have explained it to our parents. We have a very excellent parents' council. They're scared, Pat, because most of our children will come to us, yes, for the academics so that they can progress in society after school, but they come to us to belong. So we have a huge, loving, caring environment. They have drifted from their peers in the mainstream, and parents want their children to be happy. So they come to us for that sense of belonging, to make friends, and parents are really scared. We would really like the minister to engage with us, possibly for her to see firsthand what it is that we offer, because as I said, it is a misunderstood disability. So if there was engagement, it might help.
Now, that's about the MGLD schools, which, according to the circular issued by your department, will be redesignated only for complex needs. And these kids, 140 or so of them in Navan, have to go to a different school. They're thrown out of the school that they are currently in because you have to make way for people with complex needs.
No. No, absolutely not.
Well, that's the understanding that she has from the circular.
And I'll be clear, and I went over the circular this morning because I listened to the interview. The circular is really making sure that schools are as inclusive as possible. And it wasn't just a circular to special schools, it was to all schools. So it was to your mainstream and to your special classes, to make sure that there is no admissions criteria that is so narrow that actually excludes people. So I want to be really clear, there is absolutely no intention, nor will it happen, that children are removed from their school. That's not what's happening here. That we would redesignate and children then wouldn't be able to access the school that you've mentioned. What's intended here is that we make sure criteria doesn't actually exclude people. So you have children at the moment who have not a mild, but a moderate or more severe disability. They can't go to mainstream. It's not working for them. They're not able to go into a special class as part of mainstream. Their local school potentially should be where they can go, but they can't because the criteria is so narrow.
Are you saying that the MGLD schools will now have to take in kids with more complex needs, even though they do not have the personnel appropriately trained to take care of those kids?
So what we're saying is that there would be a mixture, yes, but it is already happening. So if you think of the 124 I mentioned, and there's five new schools opening in September, there's about 30 that were designated or that started off as mild. 16 of them have already transitioned. So they've already opened up their criteria for more complex children. It's not that they can't accept mild. It's not the case at all. But what has happened with those schools...
No, you're kind of cavilling about this.
No, they still have mild children.
If they're transitioning, it means your intention is that they eventually become for acute only.
No.
And in the meantime, the kids with mild disabilities may be completely discommoded by the presence of kids with much more complex needs.
No, so what I'm saying is it's a mixture, and it has been a mixture for the schools that have transitioned, and what they've gotten is extra support. They've gotten extra teaching positions. They've gotten extra training, those schools, and it is working well by all intents and purposes. I'd be very happy to visit the school that Debbie is principal of and to engage with them, but it is already the case that schools are transitioning. It is absolutely not the case that we want to eliminate or remove children who are mild to attend these schools. And it
so all of those kids are safe in their places?
100%. Nobody's going to be removed.
If they've no extra room, then what happens to those kids you want to take care of with the acute complex needs? Where do they go? I mean, a school has a certain capacity. And if you want to add, with grants, and I know grants reveal more capacity, you've got to build a classroom. You've got to find the space to put a prefab or whatever it is, you know. So this all takes time.
All of that is happening. And, you know, I mentioned the new five classes or schools, sorry, that are opening this year. There's not just new schools that are opening this year. There's schools that are in existence, that are expanding, that are opening 2, 3, 4 extra classrooms. There's 16 special schools in the last 5 years alone have opened. And there are actually more being built. So there's more new schools being built. There's additions being added to special schools there. There's capacity for over 20,000 students in special classrooms attached to mainstream. And then you have a huge number of students with learning difficulties that are in mainstream that are being supported by the thousands of SNAs and the special education teachers that we have. So, I mean, overall, what you have to do is build up the system. But the circular that was sent out by the NCSE recently was about inclusion, not about excluding anybody.
And I know that's not the intention. May I make a comment on that? I read or attempted to read that circular. And I even got AI to look at the circular and try to simplify it for her. And it was beyond the capabilities of AI to turn it into plain English. I mean, those kind of circulars are, I mean, they're challenging even for the teachers who have to read them. I didn't have to read it, but I chose to try to read it and it was virtually impenetrable.
But you know, I think you always have to have the level of detail that's needed to give absolute clarity. And I think the particular paragraph that was mentioned around the redesignation, it couldn't be any clearer in saying that there are currently children with complex needs that cannot go to their local school, not because it's full, and that's a challenge in some areas, and that's why we're building more schools, but simply because the criteria is so narrow, they're not being included. But you also have children.
Isn't that about the capability of the school to deal with those complex needs? I mean, if you don't have the personnel, this is not, you know, just an SNA trying to help out. This requires really well-trained, dedicated people who can handle those complex needs. If you don't have that personnel, are you right even in accepting someone that you know you can't give the appropriate treatment to?
But what I'm saying to you is the 16 schools that have already adjusted that were only mild and are now accepting children with more complex needs. They have received additional training. They have additional posts. They have additional staff now helping them and supporting them. And that's working. But you have a good point. And taking it back even to the plan today and the education plan, there are a number of things that I've done already since coming into the department to try and address what is a very challenging situation. Every single teacher that's coming out of teacher training now from next year onwards will have had mandatory placements in either special schools or special classes. That's not currently the case. It should absolutely be the case if you're training to become a teacher. It is part and parcel that special education is part of it. Secondly, we have almost 80,000 teachers already. So done their training, they're in our schools. A certain amount of them will have done training. They'll be in special classes themselves or they'll be working in special schools. I am working with my department to see how we can provide greater training to all of those teachers. It's a complex environment when you have 80,000 people trying to get everybody trained up, but we have to do it.
You need more teachers as well. What are you doing about stopping the hemorrhaging of young, newly trained teachers out of Ireland and workforce planning generally and ensuring that young teachers do get a chance of a permanent contract?
Well, look, the plan I've published today, again, clearly sets out a number of things that I've already done and that I intend to do. So one of my first actions in this regard was to change the length of time that a teacher needs to spend in a school before they can get a permanent contract. It was 2 years. Come this September, anybody new starting or anybody who's doing their first year, it will be 1 year. So that, again, is to show to students, but to new teachers, to newly qualified teachers, that you're valued, that we want you to stay here and that you can be part of that school community much earlier. We're making sure that if you've trained abroad, that your qualifications can be recognised here more quickly. Again, that's a change I've made just in the last number of weeks. We do have only 2% of places that aren't filled at the moment. So I want to say that 98% of all of our posts are filled, and where we have more complex challenges, a lot of it is in secondary schools and it's in certain subjects.
Okay, but posts that are filled and then currently occupied by part-timers because people are on leave of absence. How many, what proportion of your teachers are currently on leave of absence, off in the Emirates or whatever, or New Zealand, Australia, Canada, earning good money?
So look, I think that varies at any given time.
But you
might have a couple of thousand that are away at the moment. I mean, you've over 125,000 or so that are registered with the Teaching Council. There's 80,000 in our school at the moment. So you'll never have every teacher that's qualified.
You're talking about only 2 or 3% on leave of absence at this stage. Is that your contention?
It's in and around that, I think. But I mean, it is up to the school to give the career break or not. And I have to repeat that, and we spoke about this before when I was at the teacher conferences, it's very much a decision that the school has to make, and it's clear that they shouldn't be allowing career breaks if they don't have somebody to fill the post. But what I'm doing separate to the measures that I've mentioned is I'm looking at other ways in which we can make sure that the teachers that we have, that we keep them, that we make sure we're not creating more challenges by some of the measures that we have in place, but also to fill the posts that I mentioned are often more challenging, whether it's physics, whether it's Irish, whether it's some of the Leaving Cert or the secondary school ones. What we're actually doing is creating a situation where teachers who have a base level in other subjects than the ones they're teaching, they can upskill and they can actually teach a third subject. And that's something that I've only done in the last couple of weeks as
well. One of your endeavours is to try and reduce the cost to parents for their kids going to school, and school meals is one of them. And there is a question about the provision of school meals, whether it should be more targeted. In other words, the food left uneaten or food that the kids simply don't want because they're very well fed at home. And yet to take the kind of stigma off the people who do desperately need school meals, everybody gets them. Is that a wise way to spend the money? Is there not a better way?
I think for the exact reason that you've mentioned, this is about making sure every child is equal, making sure every child, when they come into school, they have a full belly. Every child throughout the day can focus and learn. And every school that I visited, and I've been in quite a few now in the last while, have said nothing but positive things about it. Yes, we need to make sure that it's as nutritious as possible. And that's why Derek Cleary, who obviously is Minister in Social Protection, that are rolling this out, has said that come September, there'll be a nutritionist looking at how do we make sure we get the best value? How do we make sure there isn't wastage? I mean, I know there's great examples I've heard in schools recently where the packaging itself is reused. It goes back. We're not throwing out anything. And it's about making sure that, as I said, it's healthy, it's nutritious. But the focus here is making sure no child's excluded, no child is getting something when somebody isn't, and it singles them out. Well, they don't have the money, they don't have something at home. It's making sure that there is fairness right across the system. And to me, it is absolutely money well spent. And I think it's a really positive initiative. And look, there'll always be tweaks and changes and adjustments we have to make, but I think it's working really well.
Now, AI, officials in your own department have said that the tools currently available to detect student cheating through artificial intelligence do not and will not work. That's what they said to you.
Well, I mean, we're not asking teachers to use this at the moment in schools. So a lot of this conversation is coming about because of the Leaving Cert reform, the changes that are due to take place. What I'd say to you, Pat, is at the moment there are 28 subjects for Leaving Cert that already have additional assessment components. And it's not just music or art or where you have language skills.
Well, if you're asked to play the flute, you have to play the flute. AI can't do it for you.
No.
But there are certain things that AI can certainly do for you.
It can, but in those 28 subjects, you have history, you have political science, you have home ec, you have other subjects where there are written projects already that have to be presented. And that's already happening. That's there now in our schools, part of the Leaving Cert. So you imagine for history, you've done up a project. At the moment, what happens is it's assessed by your teacher. It's then signed off by the principal. It then goes to the State Exams Commission and it forms part of the overall exam at the end of the day. What we're simply suggesting is that this applies to every subject, because what we need to do, and again, I'm going to take it back, and this is really clearly part of the plan that I published today, how do we make sure students are best prepared and that their skills are tested, that their knowledge is tested, that they have every ability and skill that they need leaving school to enter the workforce and to go on to the next stages in life. And that's what business is saying they need. They need different skills tested. They need different abilities for students. And that additional assessment component is key to that. Some
so
of the new exams.
How do you test that? I mean, project work was supposed to be
by our teachers who know best. And I absolutely trust our teachers.
But if they're throwing their hands up saying, we can't tell whether that history essay was written by a machine or written by my student. Or are they supposed to say, well, young John is pretty thick in class. He couldn't have written that. It must be by a machine or by a parent. So is that the kind of assessment they have to make?
Well, what I'm saying at the moment is teachers are assessing their students' work. They're able to say, and this is, say, the exams that children are in at the moment and just finishing up. If somebody had done their history exam, they also had an additional assessment component, which was signed off by the teacher who knows their work. But there's always different stages. So, for example, the new subjects that are coming in September, three of the science subjects, there'll be additional assessment components. It's not the case that a student will be able to simply say the night before when my assessment's due tomorrow, I'm going to put something into AI and come up with something. There are five or six different stages along the way across the years where they'll be putting forward what they want to do. The next stage will be they talking about why they chose that, what their prep work is. So they have to actually go through the different stages with their teacher, with their class, show how they're doing things. And then at the end of the day, they hand up their work. The teacher will know, having gone through all of that, this is what they've done. We've worked with them for 6 months. This is where they're at. Hand it up in the same way they do now. But I mean, like, we do have to give support as well to teachers, and I acknowledge that. And that's why there was guidance and advice issued maybe back in 2023. There is a hub actually on IDGE, which is the teacher training platform specifically around AI. And there's a second set of guidance that's going to be issued now in the next few weeks for teachers. What I've also committed to, and this is part of my engagement with unions recently, is that we would have an AI oversight body. So as the changes are happening with the Leaving Cert, that we have a specific body with teachers represented on it, looking at what's happening. Are there changes we need to make? Is there more guidance we need to provide? But this should not prevent us from changing what is an absolutely necessary change for our Leaving Cert.
Send some of your officials off to Estonia to see what they're doing there, where they're embracing AI totally and they're moving. Anyway, I want to move on.
There are teachers telling me they're using it already. It's working really well. It's helping them prepare for class. It won't replace anything.
Now, but it's an important part of our life. Mobile phones and the pouches, the 9 million, which you no longer specifically designate for pouches. You say it'll be used in various ways to inhibit the overuse of mobile phones in and around schools. That the question of DCU's research suggesting that there's no point.
Well, look, I welcome the research. I think we need more, and I think DCU as well would say that we actually don't have enough kind of research specifically on mobile phones, schools banning them, and what the result is. So I think we need to do more work. But there's lots of other research out there. So if you look back to 23, the Commission, a European Commission, did a body of work to show just how long young people are on their phones. It's over 3 hours a day. There's other research to show that there's an increase in problematic social media use. There's also correlation between that then and the increase in depression, low self-esteem, anxiety among young people. There's also the ESRI research that was out today showing that social media can have and is having a negative impact on young people. So my view, and I think that of many people, it's not that we're going to completely change things by not allowing phones in schools, but if you can reduce by at least an hour the length of time that children are spending on their phones, is that not a good thing? If you can make sure that children are focused on learning in schools, is that not a good thing? If you can make sure on their lunch break, they're focused on talking to each other, engaged in sports, activities, whatever they want to do, instead of being on their phones.
That's got to be good.
Is that not a good thing?
A final point. A listener has got in touch with our colleagues at Lunchtime Live, whose daughter attends Belgrove Infant Girls School in Clontarf. And your department has informed them that they've reduced their teaching allocation, meaning that next year, senior infants will have just two classes instead of three. And what that means, one of the two classes will have 36 students and one will have 35. Now, that's just too much.
So firstly, teacher allocation, it's a very black and white system in terms of the numbers that you have. So every September, when a school does its enrolments at the end of the month, it sends those numbers to the department. And based on those, you then get your teaching
What's
allocation.
What's your target for those infant schools? How many kids should be in each of those classes?
So look, I mean, we've
said... Is it 23, 24?
Well, we've reduced on average to about 23 at the moment. There's a programme for government commitment
so
to bring that down
71
to 19.
Students in that class. Divide by three and, you know, they would have 23 in a couple and 24 or 25 in a third. Instead, they've 36 and 35. How does that make sense?
So without knowing the details of the school and the number of pupils overall, the likelihood is there are other classes with much smaller sizes. So how the teachers are then divided up within the school, that is for the school to decide. But there's a very clear criteria set in terms of the number of pupils you have, the number of teachers you may have. There are appeals process that teachers and schools can apply to. So if there are more students coming in the next year, they can make a case that we shouldn't lose our teacher because our numbers are going up again next year. So we have to set the criteria. There'll always be a line on, unfortunately, some schools if they go down below.
It's the school's fault, basically.
No, it's not the school's fault at all.
You're saying they determine, they get so many teachers to give them an average of 22, 23 in every classroom, but they have decided to have 36 and 35, and therefore in other classrooms maybe only 14 or 15. Is that what you're saying?
And I'm not saying it's anybody's fault. I'm saying a school does decide how they divide up their schools, how they decide up their classrooms, but it is the case that there's, I suppose, a set criteria. You have your teacher based on that. But I mean, we have made huge progress over years. The pupil-teacher ratio is now down on average at 23 to 1, the lowest it's ever been. We've given a clear commitment in the programme for government to reduce that down to 19 to 1. And that's something that I'm absolutely committed to.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.